kwakuwamfamnyako nauvuku na undukufu ata milele.
Broadcasting from high above the reserve, this is Radio Harambe. Jambo, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to Radio Harambe, brought to you by JamboEveryone.com. I am Dave McBride, broadcasting from the Radio Harambe studios at an altitude of 1,998 feet above the savannah, and joining me from somewhere in the world, a man who is rumored to have once had his very own greeting trail in Camp Minnie Mickey, it's Safari Mike.
Jambo, Dave, how are you?
Mike, where are you calling us from today?
You know, Codfish Island.
Is it off the coast of Maine?
No, not even really close at all.
Newfoundland?
No, not even close.
Where else they have cod?
Well, they have cod pretty much everywhere. I am off the coast. Well off the coast of New Zealand.
Oh my goodness.
We are here studying the kakapo, which is the world's only flightless parrot. It's also nocturnal.
Wow.
It is also the world's heaviest parrot. And it's one of the longest-lived parrots. It can live well into its 80s. The problem that the parrot had, and was also, it looks very much like an owl, and it's also called an owl parrot by some. The problem it has is that it's flightless, and B, when it's in danger, it freezes, and it's also kind of stinky. So when the dogs and rats and stuff were introduced to some of the islands around New Zealand, it had no chance, and it is almost completely wiped out. There's only two small populations on two small islands where they've been able to keep rats and dogs off of it, and they're trying to save them. There's maybe 100 to 150 left in the world.
So this sounds like you're at the ends of the world here today.
Yeah, we're far away.
And that explains why we haven't been able to get radio contact with you over the last couple of weeks, thus delaying our entry into the 2014 podcast world here.
Cell service sucks.
Internet service seems to be fine now, though. And Safari Mike, folks, is also the proud owner of a lovely new Radio Harambe t-shirt.
I am.
Which I just wanted to mention because we still have a couple left.
Oh, do we?
Yeah, we do. I got a couple extra. I'll put it that way. And so we still have a couple left. You can email me at safariguide@jamboeveryone.com. That's safariguide@jamboeveryone.com. I think we were charging $24 or something like that. That'll include shipping so that we can make with every shirt we sell from this point forward. I'm just going to turn the money right over to one of our conservation partners. So every shirt will make about a $20 donation to one of the conservation partners. So go to safariguide@jamboeveryone.com and email me, and I'll send you all the specifics. You're going to need PayPal to pay for them, but we still do have a couple left. Only adult sizes left. I may have a large or two, or an extra large hanging around, and a couple of larges still up in the box. I did get a couple more than I had planned on it, just because we sold a few in the first week there. And I'm hoping to start off 2014 with some good donations to our conservation partners. So. In today's show, Mike and I are going to discuss the news from Disney's Animal Kingdom and Walt Disney World. Then, in our feature segment, we will be presenting our requiem for Camp Minnie Mickey. But let's begin with the local news, Mike. And the biggest story, obviously, everybody knows about it's kind of two stories put together in the same week. We saw a big step forward in the evolution towards the new Animal Kingdom Park on Monday, January the 6th. Which was just over a week ago from the time we're recording here. Camp Minnie Mickey closed its doors forever. And only a few days later, Disney had a small, kind of a smallish groundbreaking ceremony / press event for the new Avatar Land project, which will be built where the camp once stood. The event was attended by, among others, Avatar film producer Jim Landau, Disney Parks chairman Tom Staggs, and Joe Rohde, the creative leader of Disney's Animal Kingdom, as well as a few other Imagineers. They talked a bit released a video on YouTube and generally offered no new information whatsoever. So let's leave aside the nauseating giant blue shovels, and we'll ignore that for a bit and talk a bit about what we can possibly take away from the ceremony and the subsequent video. The video can be found on the Disney Parks blog, by the way. It's also on our website, johnboeveryone.com. Click the blog, you find it there. What stood out to me, Mike, was the fact that Tom Staggs decided in the short 14 seconds he had on this video, which is really all anybody got about this groundbreaking ceremony, because it didn't seem to be attended by anybody other than a couple of press, you know, some pool photographers and some press. It certainly wasn't done to the public, it looked like to me. There was barely anybody there. Mm-hmm. From what little you could see of it. But he dedicated almost his entire few sentences focusing more on transforming the animal kingdom into a night destination rather than speaking on Pandora itself. It seems to me that this kind of speaks a lot about what Disney's focus really is here. And what I mean by that is he mentioned once again, the night parade, the nighttime water thing that we've been talking about, the Rivers of Light. He may have even mentioned the nighttime Kilimanjaro safaris. Yeah. He made a real point of kind of weaving that into the Avatar press event.
Right. He also said something about some other surprises along the way or something along those lines.
Yeah, well, they always do that, don't they?
Yeah, I know. But it does does whet your appetite.
yeah. I also found it more than a bit strange that such a ceremony, such a press event would take place, like I said, with almost nobody there, no fanfare, on a Friday morning during one of the least crowded weeks of the year.
Obviously that's when they're going to break ground. They don't want to close Camp Mini Mickey on December 31st. They want to wait until, you know, the crowds have died down so the capacity is not affected so much. So it doesn't surprise me that it did it at that time, but it does surprise me that they made such... I mean, they had, like you said, Mr. Landau there, who's, basically James Cameron's right-hand man. And you'll see him on the videos with Cameron, in the original post, when they sort of first started giving you information about Avatar Land. So, he's a somewhat of a muckety-muck within Jim Cameron's, organization. So right. He was there. They dragged Joe Rohde, who didn't even show up for the 15th anniversary of the Animal Kingdom, but they got him there to use a giant blue shovel. And I don't think there was really anything other than that. I mean, it was like a quick couple of photographs, a couple of quick words for Disney Parks blog, and off they went.
Yeah, giant blue shovels, and on the Parks blog, they photoshopped in one of the giant blue characters. I don't remember their names.
Oh, that was Photoshop? It's a Na'vi. Come on. I can't stand the movement. I know it's
Na'vi. I know it's a Na'vi. I just don't know the name of the particular one.
Oh, nobody does. I don't even think Jim Cameron knows the name of the particular
one. All right. Well, speaking of... is that all we need to say about that particular event? Because it really was nothing new, right?
No, nothing new.
And we're going to talk about the Camp Minnie Mickey closing more later and kind of give that its just... what it's due there. So let's move along. Speaking of little to no fanfare, we had a new dance party type character event debut or pop-up, however you want to refer to it. I think this past week at Dinoland USA, far as we can tell, this does not appear even on event or entertainment times guides that you get when you walk into the park. At least that's what the original reports were. It could be that they have showed up on them over the next couple of days, but we haven't heard that. The party features a pretty cool looking little truck, which I guess is the sound system. That's how these things always work. And lots of cast members and characters dancing around the area in your standard run-of-the-mill collection of current wedding songs, pretty much. But on a good side, I don't want to just completely poo-poo it here, but on the good side, some of the characters they feature, we would certainly might classify in the rare category, such as Flick, Brer Fox, and the coolest one is on a guy on stilts dressed up as Slim, who's the stick bug from A Bug's Life.
Yeah, they also have Gypsy Moth is there a lot, too, from A Bug's Life.
Yeah, but the Slim one was terrific.
Yeah, it's cool.
I would recommend people do is go to, if you don't know, Kenny the Pirate. And KennyThePirate.com. He is sort of the, what would you call him, the sort of internet maven on character
absolutely
stuff online.
He even has an app.
Yeah. So
you can... find characters. It's useful if that's your thing and you're in the parks. It's actually pretty useful.
He has lots of photos taken from this thing, and he has even some video up. I posted, linked some of those videos to our blog as well. You can find the article there. I'll be honest here, Mike. Dance parties are really not my thing. they're just not something I'm really into. And this one seems like kind of haphazard as far. I mean, if it were me, I'd prefer maybe like a choreographed little mini parade rather than, you know, I'm thinking they used to call that one that they did in the Hollywood studios. They called that. No, what was it in Magic Kingdom? There was kind of like a dance party, but it really was just sort of parade that stopped.
It was in the studio, the Pixar block party thing.
Yeah, the block party. That's exactly what it was. Yeah, I was thinking something more along those lines. This seems like they roll out a truck and people walk in and everybody kind of dances around and the truck goes away.
Right.
So I do appreciate the characters they chose here, and I also appreciate the need in the light of Camp Minnie Mickey closing. More kind of character encounters, right?
That's exactly what it is. It's the day after they close Camp Minnie Mickey, they start this parade. But this dance party. A couple of things about it that was one of the things I wanted to touch on was that it's obviously because of that. I do like the characters, and I also like the fact that it's different characters from what I can tell from Twitter and whatnot, that every time they have it, it's a different... Or at least each day, it's a different set of characters. Like one time I saw it was Daisy, Turk from Tarzan, and all three of the Brers. Brer Rabbit, Brer Bear, and Brer Fox.
Oh, really? Okay.
And another time I saw it, it was... who was it? It was Brer Fox, it was like Minnie Mouse, and then it was Slim and Gypsy Moth. So it's a different group of characters. Now, maybe it's the same characters on a particular day, right. But at least on different days or whatnot, you could see different... characters. And yeah, it's fun to have characters that you never see anywhere else.
Right.
I mean, that whole long-lost character thing was such a big deal at Limited Time Magic, one of the few good things about it, that I guess they're kind of parlaying it. Now, that truck that they have out there used to be used... they had another dance party in Dinoland. I think it was in 2011. They had it for a brief period of time called Truckosaurus Dance Party or something along those lines. It's the same truck. And they actually used that truck for the Sundowner Festival. They kind of like parked it and put like all the different festival signs on it. It's very Animal Kingdom-y.
Yeah, that I've seen. Now that I think of that I've seen.
Yeah, that truck's been kicking around for a few years at least. So, now they're using it for this dance party.
Good. Now, Mike, this next story is one I'm going to have to defer to you a bit on here, is because I'm not really able to confirm anything yet. And this all kind of comes from you. But we received reports last week that the Komodo dragon, long a mainstay at the Maharaja Jungle Trek, and really the first animal you see when you walk into the trek, and I'll be honest with you, one of my favorites, because the view of them there is really good. They've managed to make it so that I think what they do is heat one of the rocks, because it always seems to be sitting on this rock just right in camera shot. You know,
right.
So I've got dozens. It appears he's passed away. He's died.
Yeah. Apparently he passed away. Yeah, I got that from the first person who told me that was Estelle from Happy Place Bog, who's actually down there right now, or at least was down there at the time of this recording, who basically said that, did you know that the Komodo dragon died? And she heard it from one of the cast members who, you know, do the talks there along the trail. And a couple of the people on Twitter had heard it as well. So, as far as I know, he has passed away. I don't know why. I can tell you a couple things about it, though, that the Komodos are not easy to get. You know, they're in a few zoos, but you do have to go through a whole quarantine process and stuff. So, if they are going to get another Komodo dragon, don't expect one there out tomorrow. So, and also, you know, there's a lot of signs. You know, signs for the jungle trek that talk about dragons.
Right.
You know, somebody on Twitter told me it was a bad week for dragons at the Animal Kingdom. That one passed away, and they got rid of the rock work over to get Minnie Mickey.
Right, right. Well, I say I haven't confirmed anything yet. I mean, we're just Radio Harambe here. Disney doesn't tend to answer my emails or inquiries into questions like this, and I guess it's just not that important a story to them. I tried to get it confirmed. We only have these one or two reports. If anybody knows any different and we have this wrong, certainly contact us. But it seems like the information is what it is at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I can tell you as being a part of the zoo world for years, zoos don't like to tell people that animals have died. I mean, it's just not a good thing to be talking about.
Right.
At the Bronx Zoo, when animals would die, they would not even tell. I was a docent. I gave tours. I did it for 18 years. And the zoo never told us boo about an animal passing away. Now, this is a little bit different because this is the only one they have. So they can't have like another dragon out there and just pretend like, you know, right. It's the same one. So, but don't expect Disney to, you know, really talk about it if they can avoid it.
Okay.
And it's not that big of a story where the Orlando Sentinel is going to get involved.
Of course not. Of course not.
So they're just going to ignore it and, you know, sooner or later it's going to go away.
Right. Well, the next story is a much happier one. the new Dowel Bar has opened. It looks great. I'll be honest with you. This is kind of a follow-up to a story we've been discussing for a long time, this Dowel Bar thing. Over the holidays, the new one opened. You can find some photos of it on our blog. Jen from Destinations in Florida, our travel partner, has supplied me with those photos. It does look great. However, we'll say this, Mike, the ambiance has been lessened a bit, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, it doesn't feel as Harambe as the old one did. But I do think it's an improvement.
And we have new walls up, kind of, I guess, where the old one was now.
Well, yeah, like we talked about, I think we talked about this on the last episode, all those many moons ago.
Before you flew off to a remote island off the coast of New Zealand.
Yeah, Codfish Island.
Right, Codfish.
the seating area in the old Dowel Bar, now that the Christmas rush is over, has been covered up. There's walls all around it. And all those tables... I don't know how they do this, but all the tables that were back there have been moved over to the behind the Tamu Tamu.
That's not possible.
They're really cramming in as many seats in there as possible.
They must put a few on top of each other.
They said it's really just like a nightmare back there.
Oh, God.
But, you know, that's pretty much the only place to sit right now until whatever it is they do is cleared up.
And we don't know yet if they're going to go back there.
I would imagine not. I would imagine that area is going to be the pathway that leads you to the theater back there. It's going to be a wide berth, I think.
Yeah, it does look that way. It does look that way for sure. Let's move for the next, which I want to do occasionally, to do a little conservation. And it's a story I wanted to discuss because it kind of brings home the dangers often facing folks working to protect endangered species. A park ranger in the Congo Virunga National Park in the Democratic Republic of Congo was killed in an attack by suspected Rwandan rebels. According to a statement from the park officials, the attack is thought to have been carried out in retaliation against the rangers' efforts to prevent the militias from regaining control of an area close to the habitat of the critically endangered mountain gorillas. The ranger's name was Embera Bagebo, I think is how you would say that. Three rebels were also killed in the fighting. Two other rangers were wounded. For those who don't know, the Congo Virunga Park is Africa's oldest national park. It was founded in the 1920s, I believe. And it's basically there or was put there because of the mountain gorillas. But it is also home to many other endangered species, such as okapi, leopards, and a variety of birds. Mike, I mentioned this for two reasons. One, we always like to talk about really how these people put their lives on the line for some of these endangered species. But also kind of how fragile things are in that area right now with some of these species. We've discussed the okapi a few times. One of our conservation partners is the Diana Fossey Fund, who is very active in this particular, area as far as these endangered mountain gorillas. And I just kind of wanted to mention it because it's a sad story, but it also kind of brings home really how serious this is.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this once or twice in the past about how dangerous some of these areas are and how difficult it is to protect things like the okapi and the mountain gorilla when they're limited to areas like in the Congo where there's just so much fighting. You take your life in your hands by going in there and just to study the animals. You're risking your life, not from malaria and not from like a leopard hiding in the bush, but from rebel fighting. So.
Right.
It's a dangerous business, especially there.
And finally, I'd like to discuss quickly. Well, it won't be that quick. Quickly discuss an article. Nothing we do is that quick. Quickly discuss an article you wrote this week for the blog, Mike, regarding the controversy surrounding SeaWorld and the film Blackfish and how these issues can also affect the animal kingdom. For those who don't know, very quickly, Blackfish was an independently produced documentary regarding SeaWorld's killer whale program. Well, it's been there for ages, right, since the 70s, and certainly did not show this program. The film did not show this program in a very good light. The film itself was picked up by CNN, I believe, in 2013, just a matter of months ago, and SeaWorld has been kind of embroiled in this controversy ever since. I want to take you to task a bit, Mike, on a part where you relate to the animal kingdom, but before we do that, I just want you to kind of give us a little nickel version of the post.
Oh, okay. So basically, the nickel version of the post actually stemmed from our wish list conversation that we had, where we were listening to the podcast, myself and my wife, and we were talking. You were talking about pandas, and Brooke, my wife, mentioned I don't know if Disney would ever do that with the blackfish problems going on. And I thought about it, and it makes a heck of a lot of sense. I would be shocked. You would have to realize that Disney knows exactly the problems that SeaWorld is undergoing. This whole blackfish scandal has been an outright disaster for SeaWorld.
Yeah.
Bands like Bare Naked Ladies and Willie Nelson won't play at their park anymore. They've had to reduce ticket prices to entice people. And SeaWorld is even going on. They had like this online poll where, I think it was the Orlando Sentinel, but I'm not sure, did an internet poll, would you have been, are you affected of going to SeaWorld by watching Blackfish? And overwhelmingly, that the answer responses were no. Well, a little investigation turned out that a large portion of those no votes came from SeaWorld.
Oh no.
Yeah, so they have really spit the bit in terms of the handling this. At first they just chose to ignore it, and some sort of half-hearted we're denying everything kind of thing, and then stuff like this has just become an outright disaster from public relations point of view. And Disney, I think, has to worry about that kind of stuff when you're dealing with animals. And we just talked about the Komodo dragon, about how they're going to stick their head in the sand and they're not going to come out. There's not going to be a Disney Parks blog saying, oh, the Komodo was great and we're going to miss them and all that kind of stuff. They're just going to ignore it. And if you have pandas, you can't do that. Unlike the Komodo, the death of a panda is a big news story. And it was a problem for the National Zoo they lost a couple of cubs, panda cubs, initially. And it's bad press. And Disney, I could see Disney saying to themselves, okay, pandas are popular. Pandas are expensive. Do we really want to risk? Do we want that kind of, it's not like, a ride that we can fix. We can't fix a dead panda.
Right.
So, maybe there's a little bit of trepidation in doing something big like that with terms with an animal because of the whole blackfish scandal.
Well, okay. So let me jump in and let me give you a little counterpoint with this.
Sure.
First of all, everybody knows if they listen to the show that I'm an advocate for bringing pandas to the animal kingdom, and I have been for years and years. I think it would be great for the park and for the guests, and and for the betterment of the species for the forward in the long run. There's two main issues here. One is SeaWorld is being accused of basically the lack of a better term. Now, I have only seen very few bits of this film, so I can really comment on is what the fallout is, which really in the long run is all that matters, right? I mean, the content of the film really isn't what's a debate anymore. It's what people's reaction to it is. And that much I've certainly read about. And the idea that is now in the ethos is that there was mistreatment in one way, shape, or form, whether it be in the 1970s or even happening now. And it all stems from the death of a handler. Or at least that's probably what the impetus was of the film, correct?
Correct. Okay. The film itself is basically they take the death of Dawn. I forget her last name off the top.
Yeah,
of my
I
head.
Can't remember it either.
Or something like that.
Yeah,
her death at a killer whale, and they kind of expanded that out because after that there was an OSHA investigation, And it was that investigation that led to, and for people who haven't been to SeaWorld in some time, they don't any longer have, or they certainly not now because they canceled the show, but for the last few years, they didn't have the handlers in the water with the killer whales. They stopped doing that portion of the
right.
of the show. You people maybe remember, like, you know, the handler would ride the back of
sure, they'd shoot him up into the air and all sorts of stuff. Yeah, yep.
That was all gone after this investigation, and OSHA put down some rules. And then they went back and they went, and in reality, it was a little unfair because they went back and they showed how they actually captured some of the killer whales. And it was brutal.
But that was from 40 years ago.
Yeah, it was 1970. I mean, we're really going to criticize them now for that. They don't do that anymore.
Right.
And, you know, they don't talk about all the good things that SeaWorld does in terms of rescuing sea turtles and manatees and that kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of good comes from SeaWorld in terms of that kind of stuff. A lot of good educational things that any good zoo does too. So that kind of was not talked about at all during this film. The film was really about this OSHA investigation and the death of this poor woman.
Okay. And you also make a great point in the difference. We're just going to narrow this down to the conversation between pandas and comparing pandas to the killer whales. You also mm-hmm. make a great point in there about the, you know, the habitat differences between the two are enormous. I mean, a killer whale is a migratory species that, you know, covers miles and miles a day.
Right.
When a panda bear, if you're going to put food out every day in your backyard, if your panda lives in the woods behind your yard, he's probably coming to your house every day. So it's a habitat. It's a not a habitat, a behavioral type of thing that makes the comparison kind of a little difficult. And also makes it kind of in light how hard it is to keep the killer whales. So you mentioned one thing, and let me just quote the posting that you did today. I feel like I'm grilling you.
Nobody smells something.
No, you wrote, the animals, referring to the pandas, are hard to care for. The National Zoo has had so much trouble with theirs. Several cubs were born only to die within a few days. And zoos hate when animals die. A, it's just sucky, and B, it's bad press, which is pretty much the same thing. And while I agree with this, I think
I meant sucky because...
It's sucky because an animal died. Yeah, but... Right. I agree with this, but I think you make one big omission in your process towards this conclusion. Okay. Killer whales are, as far as we know, not endangered. Now, that's not a reason to say you should save one over the other, but some local populations are under threat due to habitat and prey issues. That's true for almost any animal anywhere. But estimates seem to range from, you know, anywhere between a minimum of 50,000 to 100,000 or even more. At the same time, we do know that pandas are endangered. They are the rarest bear on the planet, if I'm not mistaken. Their population is only somewhere in the 1,500 range. So, Mike, my point is this. SeaWorld's orca program is not critical to maintaining the survival of a species.
No, not at all.
But I'm fairly sure that the opposite is true for pandas. And if it's not for zoos around the world and the love for pandas that people who attend these zoos seem to have, it's very possible this bear would have been extinct decades ago.
Oh, sure.
And so in my opinion, that's just the type of risk Disney should take. So that's kind of my counterpoint to what you were writing.
I, for one, and even after watching Blackfish, I feel strongly about this. I don't think orcas should be kept in captivity, at least with the capability that we have currently to keep them.
Right.
I do not feel that way about pandas. I think they're appropriate to be in zoos, and I think what you just said, they could very well be extinct right now if zoos and breeding programs in China, mostly, didn't, you know, have a breeding program, didn't keep them in captivity, didn't try to save them.
Right.
I wholeheartedly agree with you that zoos should promote the breeding and keeping of pandas, for awareness and just to save them. The point I was making is Disney may look at that and say, you know, that's maybe not something we want to get involved with. Let's stick to less profile animals that, if something, God forbid, something bad happens, won't be a big news story. Because I don't want our own Blackfish. I don't want stories in the newspaper about how, you know, Ling Ling, our panda at the Disney's Animal Kingdom, just died. We don't want that. So that was my only point. My point was not that they should not be kept in captivity, like I think maybe killer whales should not be. My point is, I just don't know if Disney's going to get in bed with that.
Well, and that makes sense. I mean, what we were talking about before was, you know, you can slip in another cotton top tamarind and nobody knows the difference. You can't do that with a panda because you only have one or two to begin with. And people get very excited about the cubs. That's something I kind of always felt the Smithsonian kind of does a little wrong. They shouldn't make such a big deal about it and constant press releases until the thing is, you know, because Mike, you and I know panda cubs are not an easy animal. They come out incredibly small. They don't come out ready to go like some animals do. Like you see a zebra get born and half an hour later it can run. You know,
that's true for most predators. They don't come out ready to rock and roll.
Sure, but the pandas are very difficult that way, and they always have been. They're difficult to breed. They're difficult to maintain the young. So I always thought the National Zoo, kind of maybe could use a little help in the public relations with that. You know, maybe try to keep it quiet.
It's hard to keep that quiet, though.
Well, Mike, they do things like Cub Cam on the internet. You know, I mean, they just don't need to do that. I don't think they really need to do that until they're ready to go. Because, yeah, people do get excited and people don't understand how hard it is to do this. And they don't understand the mortality rate of a panda cub is very high. And there's nothing they could do about that. I guess I kind of took exception with the idea of, you know, blackfish being an abusive sort of situation and thinking that people might extrapolate that from the death of a panda at the animal kingdom. You know, animals die, and this one we would know died, obviously. You know, it's going to die eventually, and it'll probably die in captivity. And it would probably die at the animal kingdom if it stayed long enough. But I guess the inference of some sort of, like, blackfish thing surrounding it is what I sort of took exception with.
Well, and it wasn't so much that Disney would get criticized of, you know, wrongdoing.
Right.
So it's bad press. And to be honest, if an animal like this dies, it becomes bad press. And you know there are animal rights activist groups that get ready to, you know, start getting in the press and making comments about how animals shouldn't be in zoos. And, you know, pandas, they don't do so well in captivity, so they shouldn't be in zoos and all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just all that kind of stuff is going to happen if you have a panda that, God forbid, dies, especially a cub. You know, so that was my only point. Not that, you know, people would make a movie about how horrible Disney Animal Kingdom is.
And we know that from the very inception of the Animal Kingdom, they have been very aware of the difference between the local zoo and Disney when it comes to those things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have always had that fear.
Yep, always. Right from the get-go.
All right, I just thought we'd mention that. It's probably the biggest zoological story in the world right now. And since you wrote about it, I thought we would talk about it just a little bit on the
And it's a very good movie. It's on CNN Films, Blackfish. It's interesting. But, you know, make sure when you watch it, you know, watch it. I recommend people see it. But keep in mind that, you know, it's really sort of one-sided.
Yeah, and that's what I always say about things like that. Documentary films, independently produced documentary films, are produced from the point of view of the person who is producing the film. And he's not producing the film because he thinks it's wonderful. And it didn't come on CNN because he thinks that SeaWorld is wonderful. It came on CNN because of the opposite, and he produced it for that reason. So like Mike was saying, there's inferences of things that are happening. You know, we're supposed to be criticizing a company for the actions they did four decades ago.
And to some degree, but not all of it.
I mean, not all of it. No. And I think you're 100% right with the way you're, you know, and I don't want to pile on SeaWorld here, but I will. I think you're 100% right over the things in the recent years. The idea of one of these animals in captivity really doesn't seem like a great idea, I'll be honest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm guilty. From when I was a kid, I went to SeaWorld and I loved that show and like seeing the animal. I mean, they're impressive. I mean, there's beautiful. No getting around that. They're impressive animals, and to see them that close and jumping out of the water and stuff is a sight to behold.
Yeah.
But as I've gotten older and gotten involved with zoological stuff and things like that, I've gotten to the point now where I really just don't like it.
Well, we agree 100% on that. So let's take a break and we'll come back with world news on Radio Harambe in just a second.
I'm Explorer Mickey, and like most kids, I love zebras, and some of the coolest are the Grevy Zebra. But if things don't change soon, there won't be any left in the wild. The Grevy Zebra Trust is doing everything they can to help keep them from extinction. But there are only a couple of thousand left, so we have to work fast. Go to their website, GrevyZebraTrust.org, and donate anything you can. Even a small donation will help keep the Grevy Zebra alive for us kids and the future generations to enjoy.
Welcome back to Radio Harambe, and thank you for joining us in this episode. And now it is time for the world news, and coming to us from Catfish Island, somewhere in near Australia, is Safari Mike. Mike, how are you?
Did you say catfish or codfish?
Which one is it?
It's Codfish Island.
That's the one I said.
You ready for some world news?
Yes.
Well, we'll start off the world news at the World Showcase.
Good.
I think we've talked about this a couple of times.
There's going to be a new country? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Russia is on the way.
Yeah. So,
Spice Road Table has opened up on the shores of the World Showcase Lagoon. It's actually a pretty little restaurant. It opened up a couple of days ago. It's a tapas place, which means they serve small plates. Very Mediterranean, Spanish, as you would think. From the location of it on the World Showcase,
right.
It's not all Moroccan though. I mean, unlike most of the other places, it's really kind of more. You know, there's a lot of Greek stuff in there. There's a grape leaves, some lamb. There's a Mediterranean omelet and stuff like that. If you are a fan of the portions that you get at Food and Wine Festival, you'll probably enjoy the portions here. And if you're a fan of the inflated prices from Food and Wine Festival, you'll probably also appreciate this place.
Oh, great.
it does look good. I have to admit that looking at the food items, the sangria, apparently, which is like a signature drink there, is supposed to be phenomenal. I would want to try it. It's a pretty place. The food looks pretty good. The only problem I have, besides the price, but everything in Disney's overpriced,
yeah,
is that a tapas place... You know, with a tapas place, you get two or three plates, you know, and share it around and whatever.
Right.
So you order, there should be a large selection of things. Here, there are only about 10 different items. That's too limited, in my opinion, for
10 items on a tapas menu?
Yeah, there's only 10.
That's nonsense.
It's too limited. Too limited.
That's about a third of what you would normally expect on a tapas menu. That's the whole point of tapas.
Yeah, I mean, I would think at the bare minimum you would want to get into the mid-teens, like at least 16, 17, 18 kind of items.
Well, you're thinking if somebody comes in and sits at the table, right? They're going to sit at the table. They're going to order, you know, four or five of these. Even two people would probably order three or four of them. At 10 items, that means you're asking people who walk in the door to like almost half your menu.
Right.
Want to eat half your menu.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that just doesn't make any sense. And that's why tapas does a lot of little, you know, a lot of different things. So
yeah, that's the whole point. Whole bunch of like little things you can try. And, you know, you sit with four or five people, you get a couple of different things, you pass it around. That's the whole point of the tapas experience. And I think they need to expand the menu here, but they probably won't.
Cool. It does look nice, though. It's a good location.
It is nice looking. They did a nice job of decorating it, but...
And it's in Morocco, so you'll always be able to find a table. Right? I mean, that's the one restaurant nobody wants to go to because they're afraid of Moroccan food.
I suppose, but it'll be interesting to see if this place kind of takes off because tapas is becoming a popular thing, and it's not really Moroccan. It's Spanish, so we'll see. We'll see what happens with it.
A little bit of Spain and Morocco and Florida.
Yes, makes a lot of sense.
Okay, what's next?
Let's do a wide array of My Magic Plus little brief news items.
Okay.
As of a couple of days ago, the Legacy Fast Pass, and for those that don't know what that means the old paper Fast Passes.
I hate that term.
Why?
It's just so stupid.
Well, what do you want to call it?
The Fast, old Fast Pass. This is now Fast Pass Plus.
The Legacy Fast Pass.
Legacy now- Fast Pass makes it sound like, you know, a Hall of Famer from the Brooklyn Dodgers. I mean, Legacy Fast. I'm sorry.
The Joe DiMaggio of fast passes.
Right. That's what I mean. It's certainly not. Go ahead.
Is now extinct in Magic Kingdom. They have turned it over to Fast Pass Plus only, much like they were testing at the Animal Kingdom, and they're still doing that at the Animal Kingdom. They did not go back after a few days or so. It's still continuing, and we're going to plug along. I think sooner or later, Hollywood Studios and Epcot will both probably go the way of no more legacy Fast Passes, probably within the next few weeks. But the Magic Kingdom is now legacy pass free.
So I have a friend of mine who just yesterday or the day before yesterday went to the Magic Kingdom, and and he's not a annual pass holder. He doesn't, you know, he's down there with his family. He's got three small kids. You know, he goes to the Mouse once a year. They go down to run the marathon, and he brings his kids there, and they go up and buy their ticket to get in, and they hand him the band. Or something like that. I guess he got the band.
Okay.
And they hand him in. And they explain it to him. But while they're explaining it to him, he's got three kids saying, "Daddy, I want to go in, yada, yada." So he's not really, you know, he's thinking he's getting yada, 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 right? So he goes in. And about 15 minutes later, I get a text on my phone saying, "Where are the fast passes?" And what do I do now?
Yeah.
And that's just what's going to happen to everybody. I mean, well, you know, not people who listen to this show probably, and not certainly not people who blog and that kind of stuff. They're going to be fine with it. But, you know, we've discussed this a million times before. But, yeah, I the reason why I know about this legacy Fastpass going away is because the legacy now is people who are going there this week have no idea what they're supposed to do to get on rides.
Well, so, I mean, they're putting, you know, putting these people to the fire. We're testing them out, that's for sure. But one thing you could have told them, Dave, was to head over to the Heritage House, the old gift shop right by the Hall of Presidents, because that is now, it closed not that long ago. It has reopened as the My Magic Plus Service Center, much like a portion of Creature Comforts was in the Animal Kingdom, and like Sidka Hinga's is over at the Hollywood Studios. This is now the place to be to you know, get some help with your Fast Pass Plusing. Magic Plusing.
To complain.
Right. I imagine there will be some complaints there, yes.
Well, it's a shame. It's another one of those stores that, you know, 15 years ago was a really cool place, especially for history buffs. It was right next door to the President's Hall of Presidents. It had used to have some great books and some great kind of like memorabilia from past presidents and things like that. It was really neat. That's kind of, you know, like just like Sid Kahinga's, that whole idea sort of become less and less so as years went on. To the point where, you know, it was just another gift shop that maybe sold a couple of Mickey Mouses and Uncle Sam outfits instead of, you know, that's really what it was the last time I went there. Maybe a few things here and there, but nothing spectacular. So I guess it's as good a spot as any, other than it's kind of hidden.
Yeah, it's not like Sid Kahinga's. As soon as you walk in, there's Sid Kahinga's.
Yeah.
And Creature Comforts is right on Discovery Island. It's not when you first walk in, but the Heritage House is kind of off.
Yeah.
I mean, every square is, you know, not exactly the most traversed area of the park. You would have figured they would have put it somewhere on Main Street.
Right.
But, you know, they have not. They put it at the Heritage.
Yeah, it's definitely off the beaten path. But I understand that, you know, there's a couple of spots on Main Street they could have put it. But I understand why they're doing it the way they are. Was that all for the Magic Plus stuff, or is there even more?
There is one more.
Oh, yeah.
The full My Magic Plus testing for off-site hotel guests is going to be instituted during January of 2014. Now, what does that mean? That means that people who are not staying in Disney resort parks can, you know, test the whole array of My Magic Plus elements, not just the Fast Pass Pluses that they've been doing at a couple of the parks, but they could do the Photo Pass Plus and all that other stuff. And apparently, you'll be able to get a Magic Band if you're an off-site guest, although you'll have to pay a fee for it.
What's the fee?
I don't know.
Oh boy.
Okay. They haven't started testing that yet, so they haven't really stated it, but they've always said that Magic Bands would be able to be purchased by off-site guests for a fee instead of the cards that you get, right? Currently, you're getting basically an RFID card that you use to keep track of your Fast Pass Pluses and stuff.
Right.
But you will be able to purchase the My Magic Plus, the Magic Band, so then you can purchase the charms and stuff that go along with the
Okay. I mean,
Disney doesn't want to restrict people from being able to purchase other items. So.
Of course. let's keep focused here.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
One more story, if you're ready for it.
Yeah, of course.
Festival Fantasy, the parade that's coming to the Magic Kingdom in a few months, they premiered another float. They have actually showed pictures of the actual Maleficent float that will be making its way down Main Street in Magic Kingdom as part of the new parade. It's actually a cool little float. It's very, they call it kind of steampunky. It's very metallic looking, and it's dragon.
They call it what?
Steampunk. Yeah.
It's a hip phrase with the kids these days?
Well, if by these days you mean for like the last 20 years, then yes. Good Lord, Dave.
I'm sorry.
But it's a cool float. I like the way it looks. And even the concept art of this parade, it looks pretty interesting. I'm not a parade guy, and we've talked about this in the past. But I think the next time I'm there, when this parade's going, I'll at least try to sneak a peek at it somewhere along the way.
Yeah, I'm not a parade guy either, and I think it'd probably take a little more than one float for me to go and look at it. But this does look cool. I do like the way it looked. It looks like they put some thought into this. It's not just a tossed together parade from old stuff.
Yeah, no, it's brand. I mean, they obviously building this from scratch. But even the other floats, like the Brave one,
yeah,
like Hansel one. It looks like a Viking ship and stuff. They look interesting. They're different than anything you've seen before, which I like.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. So that's it for the world news.
It is indeed.
All right, we're going to take another short break. And when we come back, it's our Requiem to Camp Mini Mickey on Radio Harambe, coming back in just a second.
Jennifer Green of Destinations in Florida is the official travel partner of Radio Harambe and JomboEveryone.com. Jen can do everything you need done in order to book your next Walt Disney World vacation and have the time of your life. She is an expert in everything Disney and will remove all the stress of booking your trip. And she is as committed to conservation as we are. So every vacation you book, or even every quote you request, means Jen and Destinations in Florida will make a donation to the Jumbo Everyone conservation effort. You can contact Jen directly by emailing her at jennifer.g@destinationsinflorida.com or by calling her directly at 443-424-0181. You can also head over to jomboeveryone.com and click the Destinations in Florida icon to get your vacation started. Seriously, what can be better than booking a Disney World vacation while helping to save wildlife?
Welcome back to Radio Harambe. It is now time for our feature section, and we are going to go through our Requiem to Camp Mini Mickey. I am Dave McBride from the Radio Harambe studios. Mike is joining us from Cod something, an island somewhere. Luckily, we've managed to hang on to his internet connection for the entire recording here, and that's always a good thing.
It's Codfish Island. Codfish. And I'm very sad.
Codfish.
I'm very sad.
You're sad?
Yeah.
Why? Because of the codfish?
No, Camp Mini Mickey. Miss Camp Mini.
Oh, you're genuflecting?
Yes, exactly.
Okay, so here we go. We'll just do a quick kind of rundown of the camp here. Like all of the parks that opened during the Eisner era, Disney's Animal Kingdom opened with kind of a short, kind of a small bill of fare. In the way of attractions and entertainment, not a lot of options. While additional projects were in development under construction, Disney kind of scrambled for alternatives. And let's be honest, as budgets and time began to run short, Imagineers were forced to open a temporary land to help improve traffic flow and give guests some different experiences. And to that end, Camp Mini Mickey was born. This is a place where Disney's characters go for an outdoorsy vacation. That's the theme. It's themed to be the summer camp for Mickey and his pal, set in the woods amid the Adirondack Mountains in upstate New York. Characters come to Camp Mickey to relax, do some fishing or hiking. You see them doing that. And meet up for a sing-along or a nighttime story around the campfire. Best known for being the ill-placed first home of the Festival of the Lion King, Camp Minnie Mickey also offered extensive character meet and greets, a show called Pocahontas and Her Forest Friends, and the musical stylings of the legendary Guitar Dan. Last week on January 6th, Imagineers finally fulfilled their promise that Camp Minnie Mickey was a temporary area and closed the camp for good to make way for the new Avatar project. Festival of the Lion King is being moved to a more appropriate location in Africa, and characters have been scattered throughout the park for their meet and greets. So since we have spent so much time on this podcast looking forward towards Avatar, we thought it would be altogether appropriate that on this show we look back and reflect a bit on what is now an extinct land, a club with very few members, by the way. There aren't very many extinct lands in Disney history, but we now have another one. So, Mike, where would you like to begin?
Well, I'd like to begin, as I often like to begin, is correcting you. Because you had mentioned about Imagineers developing this area.
All right.
And really, that is not the case. So what happened with Camp Minnie Mickey? And as we all know, or maybe not all, I shouldn't say that, but this was the land earmarked for the famous and never happened Beastly Kingdom.
Right.
The idea was that you would have this would be the area for the land of mythical animals. And as many of us know the story, as the costs of Africa and, you know, as the developing Asia were coming in, you know, getting astronomical, Disney decided that they could only build either a dinosaur land or a land based upon mythical animals. And I won't get into the details here, but they obviously decided to do the Dino Land. And this was going to be the area where Beastly Kingdom was eventually going to be built a couple of years down the road.
Right.
So as the park was being developed, Eisner and folks had decided, you know what, we really don't have enough stuff for people to do to really justify making them pay all that amount of money to go into this park when there's only two rides and two lands and all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So we got to come up with 6 months left in the park. Before the park was supposed to be open, they decided they needed a new land. Now, Joe Rohde and his Imagineers, who wanted to build the Beastly Kingdom, at least this is the story, told basically Eisner that, you know, we can't really devote any of our resources to it. You know, we can't do it. So Eisner, instead of saying, okay, we won't do it, decided to give the land to the Entertainment Division, who was the one who basically built Camp Minnie Mickey. And it was basically along the lines of Mickey's Birthday Land, which was this another sort of built in a couple of months kind of land in the Magic Kingdom. And it was basically geared around meet and greets just like this one. And so that's why you have this area of character meet and greets, which are perhaps the cheapest attractions that you could build. I mean, you just need to pave a few roads and build a couple of huts
for the
characters to meet. And a couple of stage shows. Both Festival of the Lion King and Pocahontas debuted with the opening of the park. You can see throughout the park throughout that land back then, how temporary they thought this land was really going to be. Even the bathrooms, if you went into the bathrooms, there was no counters. It was like these off-the-shelves sinks that were just shoved onto the wall. There was no real design to them. I mean,
I don't remember that.
They really thought that, you know, why are we going to spend, you know, a couple of bucks here to build nice bathrooms when we're going to tear it down in a couple of months to build bathrooms themed about mythical animals? So they were really kind of cheap. The Lion King Theater, when it was initially open, and we'll get to that a little bit more, was all open because they didn't want to build the walls and spend a lot of money on a real theater. It was just sort of, it was basically just a roof over some bleacher seatings. And even the seatings at both Pocahontas and Festival of the Lion King are not fancy by any means. They're you know, you feel like you're in a high school, right. You know, watch football game sitting at these things. But anyway, so that was the sort of the impetus of the park, the land itself, this sort of cheap, at the very last minute, all done by the Entertainment Division kind of thing. And the decor, as you said, Dave, was based upon basically a summer camp. And you get that vibe throughout this area. The Adirondacks was the theme from, you know, upstate New York. And even the cabins for the kiosks, because they didn't want to build a restaurant because this place was all going to be torn down in a couple of years. So they just built a couple of really simple log cabin looking counter service areas that served hot dogs and funnel cakes and stuff like that. They didn't build any stores, even though the Festival of Lion King was a popular show. They didn't have a Lion King store there, which you would get in the land that you would think would be more permanent. They just had that little sort of a cart that sold Lion King stuff right on the path there. So that is sort of the legacy of Camp Minnie Mickey. This sort of, was thought to be temporary, and 15 years later, they're finally tearing it down.
Couple of things. It blows my mind that they never actually developed a gigantic Lion King store somewhere in that space, as they finally came to the realization in probably around 2001 that this wasn't going anywhere. Certainly not in the near future. Go ahead.
They didn't change the theater. You're probably right around the 2001, because they actually enclosed the Festival of the Lion King Theater in 2003.
Right. So at that point, they knew that they were going to be there for a little while. I'm surprised it never stayed. The other thing is, when we talk about theming, we are really talking about a couple of kiosks and what look like sort of garden statues. Which you can buy. They look like things you can buy at Target, let's be honest. That kind of hang around sort of just off the paths. Ones of Mickey fishing and Donald and the three little ones.
Huey, Dewey, and Louie
going on a hike or something like that.
They're earning their junior woodchuck badges.
Yeah. These kind of things are, that's really it. I mean, that's the theming.
There were some cute touches, like the bird houses that had, instead of just the oval shaped thing for the bird, they had the Mickey shaped ears, for the birds to go in, and the meet and greets for themselves. Each of the kiosks were themed a little bit different. They had four of them. There was the Adirondack kiosk, which originally was for Mickey and friends. There was the Woodlands kiosk, which was initially for Pocahontas. That was where you met Pocahontas and Miko. They had the storybook kiosk for Winnie the Pooh, and they had the jungle kiosk for the Jungle Book characters. But of course, as the years went on, they kind of lost that theming. They still looked a certain way, but they didn't really, make sure those characters were in those spots.
Yeah, they kind of went to sort of a generic movable sign kind of thing.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. That was the character meet and greets was really sort of the, as you said from the beginning, was really sort of what, the focus of what they wanted to do at this particular place. We mentioned the Festival of the Lion King, which Mike, for those of you who don't remember, Mike kind of quickly went through it, was an outdoor theater at first. Right. And for people who weren't there back then, it's kind of hard to see it. You can tell from the grandstands that they were outdoor theaters. There was also another show. The theater was there up until the day they closed, the Pocahontas show.
Mm-hmm. Which is an underrated show, I think. I don't know how you feel about it.
I only saw it once. It really was kind of it was a nice show. I saw it once years ago. Talk about that for a minute, Mike, because I think that's probably the one thing at Camp Minnie Mickey that people maybe don't remember, or a lot of people didn't see.
Sure. It was Pocahontas and Her Forest Friends. It debuted when the park opened, so it was a opening day attraction. However, it closed on September 28, 2008, so it lasted just over 10 years. It was basically, the story was trying to teach conservation and learning from animals. It was Pocahontas, and they had Grandmother Willow, for people who don't know the movie, that she was a character in there. And they also had a made-up character for the show called Sprig, which was this little tiny tree with like these little arms that both those last two were audio animatronics. And Pocahontas would come out and they would, they would bring out live animals as part of the show. It would be things like opossums and raccoons and that kind of thing. And it would teach children and it was really geared towards kids, younger kids. They actually had, much like you see at Turtle Talk, where all the little kids could come up and sit in the first few rows. That's right. What they sort of did here at Pocahontas. They had a section for the little kids who would come up close to the animals. And, Pocahontas would teach sort of this ecology kind of story about how you have to learn from the animals, learn from nature. and not just destroy it. It was a cute little show that, lasted 10 years, which is not a bad run, considering that it wasn't supposed to last more than a couple of years. And the other interesting thing about this show was, and also Festival of the Lion King, by the way, is that they were sort of, I mean, Disney was so cheap in developing this land is that they rehashed some other stuff. There was a parade at Disneyland called, I think it was Lion King Celebration, which mm-hmm. lasted from 1994 to 1997. And they also had a Pocahontas show called, I wrote this down somewhere, I forget what it was called. It was the Spirit of Pocahontas, that was it. That was also in Disneyland, and that closed in 1997. And of course, 1997 was the year before the Animal Kingdom opened. So they had, in that Pocahontas show, they had this Grandmother Willow. In the Lion King parade, they had basically those floats with the animatronics that you see
right.
in the Lion King show. So they just sort of recycled this stuff from Disneyland, across the country, and just brought it over here, threw it together for a quick little show. You know, it's sort of a testament to, Disney in itself, where they basically, within 6 months, put together, at least I think, a cute little land that, served its purpose well, I think.
Yeah, Mike, it'll always be remembered as sort of the microcosm of kind of the, of everything that people sort of didn't like about the Eisner era, but at the same time was kind of lost on those who weren't really dialed into that, if I'm making any sense with that. The longtime Disney fan would point, and the Disney fanatics, of which we are included, would certainly point to Camp Minnie Mickey as being a temporary land, which was supposed to make way for a fantastically imagineered area of which the budgets were cut. A phrase often muttered during development process of parks in Michael Eisner's days. I mean, certainly a criticism that he gets, rightly or wrongly. It's one that we hear a lot of. But at the same time, like you say, even though it probably lasted a few years longer than it really should have, and it took Disney quite a while to come up with something, and we can debate whether or not Avatar is an improvement, but it took them a while to come up with the investment and to finally kind of reinvest into the Animal Kingdom, into the area that they always wanted to make it. It's kind of that microcosm of how that whole Eisner thing happened. With great ideas and great fanfare and then kind of coming short on the delivery and then never really, breaking down the doors, never really blowing people away after the first initial ideas and then throwing away the idea of theme just to sort of fill things. It just so happens that at Camp Minnie Mickey, the stuff that they filled in with, let's be honest, the Lion King doesn't belong in Adirondack, New York. But it was a great show, right. So people liked it. So, it was kind of one of those things where those of us who love the design of the Imagineers kind of went, this is nuts. But the average person who really isn't into that kind of thing, just there to have a good time, really didn't have a complaint.
No. I mean, yeah, obviously Pocahontas fit in a lot better.
Sure.
The Camp Mickey theme than the Festival of the Lion King.
Yeah.
But yeah, people love that show. I love that show. So, yeah. While I'm sort of glad that they're building the Harambe Theater and it should be really state-of-the-art and cool, I will, there are certain things about Camp Minnie Mickey that I will certainly miss.
Such as?
All right, sure. I will miss Blue Bear. You know who Blue Bear is?
Of course.
I did like that sign. That was a great sign. It's now gone. I don't know what they're going to do with it, but it's gone.
Yeah.
I like the dragon rock work along the water. That was kind of the homage to the Beastly Kingdom, and it was part of the old Discovery River boat tours, and they used to breathe fire kind of stuff. But it still was kind of cool to see it there. I have good memories of the cast members there who you did the Wilderness not the Wilderness Explorers, but the Discovery Club before that,
right.
Which is kind of the predecessor of the Wilderness Explorers. Katie, the cast member who got us front row seats at the Festival of the Lion King, and Mickey and Megan were able to, do the good giraffe noises and all that kind of stuff. Guitar Dan, although Guitar Dan's still around, they moved him to Rafiki's Planet Watch. But I remember when Mickey was 2 years old, he had this stuffed toy that was a guitar, and Guitar Dan sang a song called the you know, Mickey playing guitar.
Right.
It's a riot.
He's great.
Like that, yeah, it was stuff like that I'll miss. You know, hopefully Guitar Dan will stick around somewhere. Right now he's at Rafiki's, you know, that kind of stuff, I hope. You know, that kind of... It was just quaint. It was cute. You know, hopefully they'll find a place for that kind of thing. Maybe at Rafiki's, you know, whatever. Something like that.
So Camp Mini Mickey passes into memory, becomes, you know, like I said, a very exclusive club of lands that are no longer in Disney parks. We don't have a lot of them before. I wonder if, and I guess this really can't be answered until after Avatar opens, but I wonder...
What other lands are completely been demolished? Because I was talking about this on Twitter, and somebody had mentioned basically Toontown at the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, that was the first one that comes to my mind.
But it wasn't... I mean, it wasn't
Mickey's
destroyed...
Mickey's Birthday Land or whatever that was?
It wasn't destroyed to the extent that Camp Mini Mickey is. Because, I mean, if you know... I mean, Toontown at Magic Kingdom, it still has the roller coaster. They just sort of rethemed it. It still has the water play area. They just rethemed
right.
it. It still has... The character meet and greets, they just rethemed it. Don't get me wrong, Storybook Circus is terrific, but it's still at its core has some of the similar elements. They were bulldozing Camp Mini Mickey. There will be no similarities. The theater will be bulldozed. They're not carrying over anything and just retheming it.
Did they bulldoze anything for Cars Land?
They must have.
Yeah, see, I'm not aware of it, but the one that came to my mind was like Mickey's Birthday Land or the Toontown, that kind of stuff. That was what I thought of, and that's really what Camp Mini Mickey was supposed to be, was something along those lines.
Oh yeah, that's you know. Just throw up a temporary land like Mickey's Birthday Land for a couple of years until you know we're ready to you know Asia will be done and we can then start building Beastly Kingdom.
Right. So I guess what my question is in the long run. Will we look back fondly on it, or will we look back in the sort of snarky, way in which most people kind of, you know, most non-Animal Kingdom fans, let's be honest, most non-Animal Kingdom fans use Camp Mini Mickey to bludgeon the Animal Kingdom fans with, to say, oh, well, you have a a temporary land that's still there that doesn't make any sense, and yada, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, will we look back fondly on this, or is that really dependent on what Avatar does?
I don't know if it really depends. If Avatar Land is terrible, and I don't anticipate it being terrible, but let's just say it's a real dud, the ride's stupid, and you know,
right.
people hate it. Let's just say people hate it as a whole.
Right.
People probably look more fondly back on Camp Mini Mickey than the norm. But I would think most people would be like, you know, I think most people will feel like I do. It was cute. There was some good things about it. It was supposed to be temporary. It probably lasted a little bit longer than it really should have. But, you know, it wasn't terrible. It was fine for what it was. Basically, that's why I will always think of it. It was a cute place to go for a little bit. But, you know, times, they are changing.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not a character meet and greet guy. I, you know, as of the time of this recording, I don't have any children, so certainly no small ones. So I didn't spend a lot of time here. But again, having said that, I never go into the almost never go into the Animal Kingdom without going to the Festival of the Lion King. It is right. It is one of those three or four things that I kind of really have to do almost every time I'm there. So I guess I'm glad that that's moving. You know, and that's going to survive. I guess the other stuff, they could find other places, and let's hope they do find other places for it. And it is a beautiful piece of land. I mean, there's a lot of stuff they can do there. It has a gorgeous bridge leading into it. I mean, the theming there is really nice. I guess I'm a little kind of, you know, to me, it kind of, it's real now, you know, it's the doors are shut. The park isn't the same as it was. It's, you know, It's on now. It's happening. You know, where it's the first sort of kick in the head. Like, you know, the next time I go back, it's not going to be the same place.
Right. I mean, I think the way I view it is I will miss it, but I don't regret that it's gone.
Yeah, I think that I like that. I think I agree with that. Yeah. Anything else we want to mention, Mike, before we
I don't think so. I think we pretty much covered it.
Well, thank you all for listening to Radio Harambe and our Requiem to Camp Mini-Mickey. please visit our website, johnboreveryone.com. I'm sure you'll find lots of photos of Camp Mini-Mickey on there, which I just realized I'm now going to have to change how we're captioning these photos. There you'll find the internet's only guide to Disney's Animal Kingdom. We have reviews of attractions, restaurants, shows, lots of information about animals and conservation. We also have a blog there. And also on johnboreveryone.com, you'll find Mike's almost weekly article on a different species of animal. I say almost weekly. Mike definitely writes them weekly. It's just a matter of whether or not the publishing department gets them published weekly.
I want to talk to that department.
Well, you know, they got a lot of work on their hand, a lot of things to do. Also, we have. I'm sorry.
Stop watching hockey and start publishing.
Okay. Also. And while you're there, we also ask you to visit our conservation page, see how we can all help save wildlife. I mentioned at the top of the show the Radio Harambe t-shirts. If you go to our blog, you'll find some pictures there on the blog. You have to go back a couple of weeks, but I'm sure there's a Radio Harambe category you can click. If you're interested in one or even seeing a picture of one, I'm happy to send them to you. Mike and I will tweet one later if we have it, so you can find it there. They're $24. Every single dime goes to our conservation partners. So $24 includes shipping every time you buy one. Minus the shipping, I will donate the remainder to one of our conservation partners. And actually just sold one as we were recording this. You can also find Mike and I also on Twitter. I'm at Radio Harambe. Mike's tag is at Jombo Everyone. Mike, you got other stuff you want to plug too as far as social media?
Well, I mean, I have a Pinterest page.
Yeah, you do Pinterest. You put a lot of stuff on YouTube. There's a YouTube site.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, we do. I have trying to put some stuff on YouTube. I just put up a Everest at night post and a little walkthrough at night kind of thing. Yeah. So, yeah, there's some good stuff.
Some great stuff on there. We also have a Facebook page. If you go to johnboeveryone.com, you'll find all those links there. And you can just go start following us on those. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes. Rate us. Leave us a review. You can also listen to us on Stitcher and on Podbean. So I guess I got it for Safari Mike. I'm Dave McBride. Kwa Harini, go well, and thank you for listening to Radio Harambe.